Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is not an exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
We are living in remarkable times. A global pandemic that challenges our health and well-being, bringing with it economic and social disruption. Environmental destruction and increase in extreme weather for our changing climate that affects so many communities, big and small. And a technological transition that's changing work, knowledge and information locally and globally. As these challenges ebb and flow, the call for effective political leadership is a loud one, made by all sides of the political spectrum. We're delighted to bring together a mini-series on leadership. What is good leadership and where will we find it? And how might our future be influenced by the leaders that we choose? So welcome to Policy Forum Pod, a podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its regions. Policy Forum is produced by policyforum.net as part of the Crawford School of Public Policy. And a Crawford School, of course, is one of the Asia Pacific's leading graduate policy schools. I'm reminding listeners again to check out the degree programs and short courses that are available at Crawford at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. I'm Anna-Greta Hunter. I'm a cardiologist and physician, and I'm the Human Futures Fellow from the College of Health and Medicine. And I'm delighted to be back in the studio today with my co-host, Sharon Bessel.
Hi, Anna-Greta. It's great to be here, and it's good to be here together. We missed a couple of weeks of being together in the studio, so it's nice to be back.
It's always more fun when we're working together.
It definitely is. So I'm Sharon Bessel. I'm Professor of Public Policy here at the Crawford School. And this is really exciting to be at the beginning of this mini-series on leadership. And of course, political leadership has been much discussed in recent years. Donald Trump's approach to leadership triggered much debate about the nature of what leadership is, the place of integrity, the common good and empathy, or more correctly, what happens when these things are absent from leadership. And of course, these issues have not only been raised in regard to Trump, the rise of populist leaders around the world has raised similar questions. Crises often make or break leaders. And Anna-Greta, as you were saying, we are in incredible times at the moment. Pandemic, climate emergency, social division, growing inequality are just some of the issues that have focused attention on different types of leadership. And much has been made of empathetic leadership, as many would point to Jacinta Ardern in the wake of the terrorist attack in Christchurch and the way that she has handled in many situations. In Australia, the ways in which leaders have responded to climate emergency, to pandemic, and to some of the really confronting issues around gender-based violence and discrimination that we've discussed here on the pod have been subject to scrutiny. And so we think, as Anna-Greta was saying, it's time to take a deep dive into leadership, particularly political leadership. What has leadership traditionally been, and what new forms of leadership are emerging? How do we increase diversity in political leadership? And most importantly, as we're going to discuss today, what can we learn from history? So to begin the conversations that will unfold over the next few weeks, we're joined today by two outstanding guests, both deeply knowledgeable about Australia's political history and both deeply engaged in political issues today. Anna-Greta, who's joining us?
Yeah, we're so lucky to have these two start this conversation. Today on the pod, we've got two extraordinary experts in the area of Australian politics and leadership. Chris Wallace, who's the Associate Professor at the University of Canberra's 50-50 by 2030 Foundation. She's a visiting fellow here at the Australian National University National Centre of Biography. And Chris's work, I'm sure, will be known to many of our podcast listeners. Her work centres on structural solutions for gender equity in the public sector, leadership roles, and in political representation. Chris has written quite a number of books, most recently the excellent How to Win an Election on the Australian Labor Party's 2019 federal election loss, and, of course, biographies, including that of Germaine Greer and John Hewson. Welcome, Chris. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
And alongside Chris is Frank Bongiorno. Frank is, of course, professor and head of the ANU School of History. He's an expert in Australian labour, political and cultural history. And he's the author of many books, including The 80s, The Decade That Transformed Australia, and The Sex Lives of Australians, A History. Welcome, Frank. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Anna Greta.
So you've both heard the introduction here today, and we wanted to start by delving into the nature of a political leadership in Australia, past and present. But at the onset, is there a particular Australian form of leadership?
No, I don't think there's a particular Australian form of leadership. I think we've had different styles of leadership across our political history. I mean, I've always been very influenced by the work done by Australian political psychologists, actually, on leadership. And one of them in particular, Graham Little, boiled it down to three styles of leadership, three approaches, which he called strong leadership, group leadership, and inspiring leadership. And we find all three of those in different types of different leaders in Australian political history. We sometimes find strands of those different approaches and styles within the one leader. I mean, Little, on the whole, saw strong leadership as being very characteristic, I guess, of the centre-right of politics. He tended to see group leadership in particular as being more on the centre-left or social democratic. Inspiring, you tended, to find around sort of the social democratic side. He saw leaders like Trudeau in Canada or Whitlam in Australia as coming out of that kind of approach. And I've always found that really, really helpful, actually. And I think it holds up well, actually, in thinking about some of the leadership that we've seen internationally during the pandemic and indeed more generally in recent years with the populist revolt and all the rest of it. I mean, the populist revolt often produces, I think, a kind of over-the-top version of what Little described as strong leadership, for instance.
Chris, what are your thoughts on that? Is there a particular form of Australian leadership?
Well, I kind of like Frank's approach, and it's a very useful kind of template through which to sort leaders in a very straightforward manner. I think there is one distinctive characteristic of Australian politics compared to, say, New Zealand politics. It's very rough here. And if you talk to New Zealanders, you know, particularly those who immigrate here, including at the ANU, they often go, oh, my God, it's, you know, Australian culture, so brutal. And this was, I remember, a revelation to me the first time I heard it. But she explained that there was a much more polite culture in New Zealand. And indeed, when you look at Jacinda Ardern's prime ministership in New Zealand, you know, and admired around the world, it's easy to see how Jacinda Ardern could happen in New Zealand. You can also see that kind of prime ministership potentially happening in Australia. The obvious person is Labor frontbencher Tanya Plibersek, I think, could pull off that kind of prime ministership. The thing is, to get to that position in Australia in a polity that is so much rougher and tougher in its political practices, particularly at this minute when the Labor Party is in transition to a kind of working out how to deal with a deep fragmentation of its long-standing factional system, which it really hasn't sorted out how to grapple with. And, of course, on the LNP side of politics, dealing with other issues like evangelical takeover of its branch system and so forth. You've got a special moment in Australia which is slightly chaotic and definitely an historic break on both sides, not yet resolved. The direction in which it is resolved in both camps is very unclear. So I think that roughness of Australian political culture historically, not particularly desirable, but definitely there, perhaps on the way out, though it's hard to see, well, you know, depending on how things resolve on both sides of the major party system, I think it does make us a bit different.
So we're going to pick up on some of these issues of where we're going in terms of political leadership. And as you say, Chris, given this moment in time that we're at. But before we get there, I wanted to take us right back. And Frank, to reflect a little bit on the period when Australia's constitution was being drafted, when we were coming together as a federation, and to ask you how political leadership was conceptualised in those early days. What were the principles and the debates that were guiding some of the early thinking around leadership, and particularly the roles that Prime Minister or State Premiers would take on?
Yes, I mean, there's been really interesting research in recent years about how gendered it was actually, and the ways in which certain codes of being male, of being masculine, were really powerful actually in the way that early prime ministers, for instance, and those Federation fathers and so on, Sharon, that you mentioned, were actually framed and how they presented themselves. So, you know, a figure such as Alfred Deakin, who was Australia's second prime minister, and I guess the major figure really of the period leading up to the First World War, the image he presented of himself, the ways he was framed in media of the day, were as a respectable but also kind of, I suppose you'd say, virile man, you know, a man of great vigour, of physical vigour. The emphasis on his eloquence was very powerful too. So speech was very much a part of a sense of the kind of comportment and bearing of the leaders. And then by way of contrast, including in Deakin's own writings, it has to be said, so he was his own propagandist. He was writing secretly, of course, for the London press while he was prime minister. So, you know, you'd get these articles on Mr. Deakin said this and Mr. Deakin thought that. And of course, it was Deakin himself who was writing this stuff. But he was incredibly hostile to George Reid, another of those Federation figures and early prime ministers. And of course, Reid, in Deakin's writing, in the media of the day, is presented almost like a windbag. He was grossly overweight. He had little matchstick legs. He was seen as lacking in manly vigour and as being sort of less suitable. And we've had a colleague, Bethany Phillips-Peddleston, who's done really detailed work around this stuff on the early 20th century. And it's incredibly interesting because, you know, we tend to think of those leaders as just that, as kind of leaders in a neutral sense, but they're actually, you know, highly gendered figures. And I think when we're looking at how political leadership is still being conceived, the ordeals of a Julia Gillard, for instance, of a few years ago, the prospects of a Tanya Plibersek, we need actually, I think, to delve into the ways in which political leadership has been gendered in that sort of way. I mean, I don't think we get very far, for instance, in understanding Scott Morrison's leadership, unless thinking about the ways in which he presents himself as a certain type of man, and a very different kind of man, I think, from both of those I just mentioned in Deakin and Reid. He's clearly gesturing towards a number of more recent cultural impulses. I like the daggy dad image, which I think is different, for instance, from the physical vigour or you know, any number of other masculine images of leadership that we find in Australian history. It's a very different image, for instance, from, say, someone like Robert Menzies, you know, one of the key founders of the Liberal Party. I mean, Morrison's particular performance of masculinity is very different from someone like Menzies. And so I think that is really, I think, very helpful framework for thinking about how political leadership still operates. And I think one can translate that in some really interesting debates about what's happening in state politics too, surely, during this pandemic, with the ways in which a figure like Andrews, Daniel Andrews, for instance, has been presented, perhaps comparing that to the image of a Gladys Berejiklian. They're very gendered kinds of images that I think have been operating.
It's great to think about the way in which the leaders are presenting themselves as the image manifestation. But there are structural things behind our leadership models in Australia as well. Australia, of course, has a parliamentary system rather than a presidential one. Chris, how has the nature of our political system shaped leadership, and particularly the ways in which political leaders, prime ministers particularly, conduct themselves?
It's changed over the last 120 years since Federation. It's very interesting. My own research, I've got a book coming out next year on biographies of Australian prime ministers in the 20th century. And it's striking that there are virtually none before World War II. It was an era where ideas were dominant, leaders much more a second place to sets of contesting ideas. And in fact, up until the late 1920s, the only time Australian voters saw their political leaders was at stump meetings, if someone happened to come through and, you know, stand on the back of a truck, or in sketches or photographs in newspapers. And it's hard to think one's way into that kind of situation. You know, newsreels and cinemas showing real live political leaders in operation it was a revelation. So the second half of the 20th century and to a great extraordinary extent in the early part of the 21st century, leaders became increasingly important and ultimately have almost transcended party political interests. So now who is leading a party is of near paramount importance. And I think, you know, what Frank just described casts a very long shadow over current politics. It informs a set of stereotypes of deeply rooted assumptions about the nature of successful political leadership in Australia that are simply false and outdated. So we've already had one female prime minister, Julia Gillard. How she survived her prime ministership, I do not know. I give her great points for surviving uniquely in federal politics since Federation, a trenchant, vicious external attack and a trenchant, vicious internal attack simultaneously, while managing to go effectively full term in a minority government that passed a huge slate of legislation, including many landmark bills. Astonishing. Now, you know, Australian politics is still gripped by the memory of the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd wars framed by particular people for their own purposes and entrenched ever since. For example, just going back to the plebiscite possibility, one hears all the time, and this is so underpinned by the masculinist assumptions that are historically rooted that Frank flagged, people will say routinely, including inside the Labor Party, oh, a woman leader would never work in Queensland. Now, let's just stop and pause and think about Queensland state politics. A woman, like Plibersek, the kid of first-generation migrants, has just won her third election in a row in Queensland, Anastasia Palaszczuk, the most successful female politician in Australian state political history. So, you know, if women leaders are so bad in Queensland, how does one explain that? I mean, you look back a bit further and you remember Anna Bligh. For 10 of the last 13 years, Queensland has been ruled by a female premier. So, you know, people, you tell people this, they simply do not take it in. The resistance to new data in the face of entrenched stereotypes is so phenomenal. You know, you get a bit more of a glimmer when you add Gladys Berejiklian and point out that nearly half of Australia's population is currently governed by female state premiers. I mean, it's over. You know, women are here. Women can do it. They have done it. They are doing it. But getting people, especially key political players, especially people in Parliament House, to disengage from these deeply held, historically rooted stereotypes, and that's often for reasons of self-interest, their own political self-interest, is phenomenally difficult.
So, Frank, if we think about, you know, some of those issues that both you and Chris have raised, particularly about the deeply masculine nature of politics in Australia and the stereotypes that are so deeply held, are we seeing, if we look back over the kind of the sweep of history of the 20th century, have we seen real changes and departures at particular points? You know, if I think about sort of Menzies, Hawke and then Morrison, you see quite different leadership styles that perhaps are, you know, helped if we think through that lens of kind of strong group or inspiring leadership. Yeah. But are we kind of seeing changes over time? And what drives them? Is it driven by the strong personality or is it about social and historical context?
Yeah, I think the latter is really critical. I mean, we get styles of political leadership that are fundamentally patterned by culture. So a figure such as Menzies, who was Prime Minister of Australia for just under one-fifth of the 20th century, so in other words, you know, an enormously dominant figure, was also particularly, I think, during his second prime ministership, as he became not so much a father figure, but a kind of grandfather figure, it was a highly paternalistic style of leadership. It was the notion of the prime minister as a kind of protector of the nation and highly patrician in a way that, you know, clearly suited, if you like, a society in the 1950s, in which families were conceived as being a kind of nations in miniature, each with a father sort of in charge in the way that the nation, you know, was sort of patterned in similar sorts of ways. That's not a style of leadership that I think would be attractive in the same way today. That kind of patrician style was attempted by Malcolm Fraser to some extent in the 1970s and 80s. It, for the most part, didn't work. It wasn't a style of leadership that became culturally embedded in the way that Menzies did. And you know, more recently, we've seen in Hawke's case, obviously, an incredibly emotional, often quite emotional style of leadership that I think was also very much in keeping with changes in a broader emotional economy of that period, where it was becoming more acceptable and perhaps even desirable for men to show emotions in public. And so I think that was very shaped, if you like, by a change in context. And one could extend that, I think, to some of the styles of leadership that we've seen in the more recent past. Again, you know, someone like Morrison doesn't attempt a patrician style of leadership along the lines of Menzies. It simply wouldn't work. He wouldn't be able to carry it off personally, but I think it would also be kind of culturally unworkable and inappropriate in the very diverse and I think much more egalitarian society in terms of gender and race and class and all sorts of things that we have today compared to the world of, say, 1955. So, yeah, I think change in context do help to craft, to shape different styles of leadership. That said, I think that leaders continue to combine some of those different kinds of typologies that I was talking about earlier. I mean, in Morrison's case, I think very interestingly, he tends to combine elements of a strong leadership style, but in fact the dominant mode, I think, with Morrison, bizarrely, I think is group leadership, the one that has been normally identified with the centre left. It's this notion of the nation as kind of the family or the local community writ large, which I think is very powerful within group leadership. And I think Morrison pushes that notion quite hard. So, yeah, I think different contexts do produce different types of leadership.
I might just talk about empathy in leadership and listening. Certainly, it's something that's come up a lot on the podcast over the last year or so, is talking about the importance of having our politicians listening and listening broadly to constituents. And you've touched a little bit on that, thinking about the diversity of the Australian population. If we look back into our history of political leadership, have we got examples of people who listened particularly with empathy?
Oh, it's surely a political skill. I mean, I think to be a poor listener, a bad listener, would be an incredible frailty for a political leader. But clearly some have much stronger powers of empathy than others. I mean, one of the immediate contexts in which a successful political leader in Australia has to exercise empathy is in relation to those people that surround her or him who have less power. We know, for instance, that John Howard had considerable empathy in dealing with that particular paradox of being a powerful figure, but with, you know, others around him, much less powerful, but on whose support he depended. But that capacity to listen, to take seriously the messages coming from the community, to benefit from being able to talk to people, to ordinary people in their kind of daily lives, or taking a moment out of their daily lives to interact with a politician. These are incredibly important skills.
And Frank. Yeah. Look, listening yeah. listening is a very interesting yeah. concept, and I'm loving what's happening with listening in terms of the independent groups springing up in LNP seats, people who once would have fitted in as moderates into the old Liberal Party, but now are driven out now that the Liberals have gone way to the right. So they are, you know, their politics is embedding in practices like kitchen table conversations. It is fascinating. I've been linking up with a few and going and trying to see what they're about. And it's really good old-fashioned, what on the social democratic side of politics would be called community organising, but which the Labor Party and the union movement has forgotten how to do. But, you know, let's just look at this idea of listening. And I'm going to disagree with you, Frank. I do not think John Howard or Scott Morrison are empathic.
I didn't say they were empathic.
Well, that was kind of how it came across. So I'm glad I could give you a heads up about how it's coming across.
Well, I didn't mention Scott Morrison.
Well, no, you're positioning him as a group kind of leader. And I would say at the level of political theatre in relation to Scott Morrison, you are right. But let's look at the kind of listening that Scott Morrison now does daily and John Howard used to do very, very regularly. And it's a particular kind of listening. It's how is what I'm doing and my party is doing going down with voters? And do I need to trim my sails in order to stay in power? Now, that's called doing what the polling is telling you to do to stay in power. And it's got to be distinguished from empathy. I think there's a classic example this month with the handling of the Billow family who have been incarcerated on Christmas Island. They're now very reluctantly by the government being reunited in Perth while their three-year-old daughter has sepsis as a result of significant medical neglect, clearly in state care. An absolute tragedy. Now, why is the government moving? Is it because Scott Morrison is a group leader who's going, well, the people are telling me I need to really do something about it? No, in my view, not. What has happened is people like these independent groups, especially the Voices groups in marginal LNP seats like North Sydney and Higgins, are putting up banners exposing their local members, who are in each case are LNP alleged moderates, who go along with what the government does. You know, as they say of Trent Zimmerman in North Sydney, he votes with Peter Dutton on refugee policy. You know, he votes with Scott Morrison on climate policy. This is showing up in the LNP polling. This is why a government who has been completely recalcitrant, so stubborn on issues like those surrounding the Billow incident, that you're finally getting some movement. And it's not because Scott Morrison is a group leader. It's because he's a Machiavellian leader who is a brilliant accumulator and wielder of power, who is probably closer to his pollster than his family. And that is why you're getting these tiny movements in policy in areas where the LNP has been otherwise intransigent. So I think the concept of listening has to be very carefully unpacked in all its nuances and facets. I think Scott Morrison is brilliant at the theatre of group leadership, but the substance is that he's running a very dictatorial front bench and he's a stubborn right winger who doesn't like change until his pollster says, mate, you've got to do this.
I think there's a lot more that we can unpack in this. Before we do, we're just going to take a short break while Frank gathers his thoughts and we ponder on whether there is such a thing as perhaps poll-driven empathy. But listeners, stay with us. We will be right back.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Welcome back. We're still here in the middle of a great conversation between Chris Wallace and Frank Bongiorno in our first episode of our new mini-series on leadership and democracy, particularly in the Australian context. Before the break, we were talking about empathy and listening in Australian leadership. And Frank, we thought we'd start by giving you the right of reply. Did you want to follow on what Chris was saying about the role of empathy in the way in which political leaders listen in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, I think in any democratic leadership, electoral calculation and even opportunism are simply, they can almost be taken for granted. I mean, they're a part of the makeup of any politician. So the point about listening, I guess, is, you know, what sort of avenues, what mechanisms does a political leader or indeed a political grouping or political party have for doing that kind of listening? I think Chris makes a good point about independence. I mean, one of the things that surely happened with political parties more generally, and particularly perhaps the major political parties, is that some of those avenues for listening that were there and often were there for decades, the local political brand embedded in a community, for instance, the local member who would be would attend the meetings of that branch regularly, a trade union movement that represented a very large proportion, over half the workforce, that these were effectively mechanisms of democratic accountability, but also ways in which political parties and political leaders could listen. And a lot of those have decayed, I think, with the emergence of, you know, what the political scientists call the electoral professional party. And so we have become, I think, much more dependent on the kind of personal capacities, or perhaps hostage would be a better way of putting it, to the personal incapacities of political leaders in terms of both their capacity to listen and indeed to empathise. Whereas I think there have been structures in the past that kind of effectively forced political leaders to if not to empathise, at least to listen, because that was essentially how politics worked. It was the only way that politics could work.
So, Frank, I wanted to just stay with you for a moment, but Chris, you may want to come in on this as well. So you pointed out that, you know, Menzies was in power for kind of one-fifth of the 20th century, which is quite extraordinary. And up until the point when the coalition lost power in 2007, Australia had had three prime ministers in nearly 25 years. But in the past about 14 years since John Howard lost office, we've seen six different leaders, which of course included the Rudd-Gillard kind of situation that you spoke about. I'm wondering what this kind of leadership churn is doing for the nature of leadership and the nature of representative politics in Australia, and also how it impacts on things like listening and empathy. You know, does it mean that leaders are so focused on what's happening within the party and their position within the party that's taking all their energies? So what's your take on the implications of this churn for leadership?
Yeah, I mean, the general impression, we don't know, but the general impression is that it has eroded political trust. I mean, as I think is pretty widely known, the surveys that have been carried out roughly over the decade to 2020, and I use that year advisedly because things changed then, but up to that point, generally, when people were asked questions about political trust, you know, are politicians in it for themselves or for everybody? Does it make a difference who we elect? Those sorts of questions. The surveys tended to indicate declining political trust. That changed. A number of surveys were done during 2020 locally, as well as things like the Edelman Trust Barometer, and they found a really significant turnaround, a turnaround that's probably on the way down now. We have, I think, one result from one of those surveys, one around public leadership actually conducted by Swinburne in the earlier part of this year, which suggests that the heights of 2020 no longer there, that we're sort of in a slight decline again, at least it may continue. But what is interesting is that, you know, a lot of that leadership churn, I think, did sort of coincide, at least, with surveys that talked about declining political trust. So I think that was probably one of the consequences. Did it sort of incapacitate leaders in certain ways? I think, Sharon, you're suggesting, you know, their capacity to listen to the public, to respond to the public in creative ways. Well, I would have thought so. I mean, if you're preoccupied with your kind of internal politics, with the internal party situation, and if you know, your party has sort of become beholden to focus group politics and to whatever the latest opinion poll is, it probably doesn't make for a really productive relationship between the leaders and the led, between political leaders and those that they represent, because, you know, it's almost like Pavlov's dog, isn't it? You know, the people speak in the latest news poll, and the party apparatchiks act accordingly in Canberra. It wasn't quite as bad as that, but there were occasions where it approached that kind of thing. So, yeah, look, I think that's probably true that in some ways the leadership churn during those years has had broader and negative democratic effects. The implications of that, as we hopefully are now coming out of this pandemic, are really interesting. Are we going to see a maintenance of the relatively high levels of trust that the surveys have disclosed during 2020? I suspect not, but they may not go down to the kind of sub-basement levels that I think we saw in that period of about 10 years, really from about 2009, 2010 onwards. That seems to be where the surveys really went down. When Abbott was elected in 2013, for instance, there was no indication in the Australian election study conducted that year of anything like the kinds of levels of trust that had accompanied the election of Rudd, or indeed the election of Howard back in 1996. The graph just kept going down. And so I think that's quite telling, but things seem to have turned around a little bit more recently.
Chris, what do you think about this period of leadership churn in Australian politics? Has it stopped us from getting stuff done? Has it impacted on our policy agenda and on meaningful change?
It's really interesting thing to consider whether it's a cause of declining trust, a cause of dissatisfaction, or it's something else. And I think in political analysis, a very commonly committed error is to think of an issue, think of a plausible solution and go, it must be that, rather than thinking of all the possible explanations, evaluating them, seeing in fact whether there's a mix of reasons, rather than kind of glomming onto one. And I think there's so much bad politics and so much bad policy around that fundamental analytical error. So personally, I have a theory that there's an enormous hunger across the electorate, not just in Australia, but everywhere, for good government. So I actually see leadership churn as a proxy for bad government, or with opposition parties, ineffective opposition operations. And to the extent that that reflects bad government and ineffective oppositions, that generates distrust, dissatisfaction, all those dire polls you see of, you know, young people losing hope in democracy. And I think there's an enormous scope for any political operator who can just grab hold of the idea of, you know, not empathic government, not this kind of leadership, not that kind of leadership, but someone who will take account of what people really need done in their lives and get it done. I think if you can do that in politics, you're in for a long run. I think the leadership churn on the LNP side where, and let's just pause and focus on this remarkable statistic for a moment. The LNP has won three consecutive federal elections with three different leaders, each of them coming to the job covered in blood from a leadership struggle. Voters didn't care. They were re-elected every time. Now, I think one of the missing things in the conversation so far is that leaders and governments operate in a context. And I'm very fond of sporting analogies. I like to point out that a player only ever can play as well as their opponent allows them to. And I think, you know, Frank, going back to the Menzies long run, you'd probably agree that the Labor Party being bedeviled by poor leadership, first in the extremely brilliant but unstable Doc Evatt, and then by the very earnest, worthy, but plain and dull Arthur Calwell, made it relatively easy for Menzies to do a Menzies. And I think if we look at the current era where the Labor Party has, if anything, I think, overlearned the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd lesson and is going through an it's my turn leadership culture where, you know, a kind of earnest driver like Bill Shorten can get his two turns, and now another earnest driver like Anthony Albanese wants his two turns. Meanwhile, you know, there's not an effective opposition leader who can do the job of attracting votes, enough votes to get more seats on the other side and form government. And I think the Labor Party's failure to really deal with its internal processes and deliver effective, attractive leaders who can win elections is one of the dire elements in the LNP's underperformance, because they have been overwhelmingly in government for decades now. And to the extent that Labor is not providing sufficient challenge to the LNP to lift their standard of government, I think it's dire overwhelmingly for Australian democracy. So I'm all for both sides lifting their game. It's not good enough for one side to lift their game. They both need to do it because we need a much, much better standard of government in Australia than the one we've been getting for some time now.
Yes, it is a two-horse race, isn't it? Still, really. I mean, you know, there are independents, there are minor parties, but at virtually every election in Australia, voters face a choice, don't they, between one side or the other governing. They like to imagine they can somehow engineer a minority government sometimes, but you can't actually do that, not easily anyway. And so it depends. The results of any election will depend fundamentally on really two sets of judgments, don't they, Chris, on how the government's going, but also whether the opposition is worthy to be the government. And I suppose in the case of the Labor Party, you know, there is also unquestionably a global sort of crisis of parties of the centre-left and particularly social democracy. Some have virtually disappeared. I mean, French socialists, for instance, have really no longer exist. Now, the Labor Party isn't quite in that situation, but its vote has been in a kind of secular decline. And that provides, I think, a part of the context for its grave difficulties, really, in Australia's electoral process.
I'm interested also in the idea of courage in leadership. Chris, you were talking about, you know, being able to identify what it is the electorate wants and being able to deliver that. But I wonder too if there is something about the idea of taking a stand that may not necessarily appear popular, if it does appear to be the right thing to do. But of course, what is right is highly subjective, and it depends who's making that assessment. I mean, I always think for me, you know, John Howard's stand on gun reform was an example of this, and I must confess I'm not generally a great fan of Mr. Howard. But Frank, what does history tell us about courage and leadership? Is it important, or is it more important for leaders to be seen to delivering on what's popular?
Well, they do need to take a stand. They also need to take responsibility. I mean, I was listening with interest to Chris's point earlier about the hunger for good government, and I think you could even break that down a little and say the hunger for responsibility. And I think that that may be a kind of positive sign that's come out of our current pandemic, that political leaders who have basically accepted at least a measure of responsibility, or even when they've perhaps tried to slip out of full responsibility, have at least been there. And I mean, obviously Andrews in Victoria is almost the paradigmatic case of that. Seem to have done pretty well. Those who have basically said, it is my job to deal with this. It is my job to protect you, that very old impulse of politics, of government, you know, my job to protect you, and have basically done their best to do it and have done it with a reasonable level of competence, have been rewarded. You know, we've had state governments re-elected. We've had extraordinary surveying and polling results for particular state governments and premiers. So I think that act of courage, of taking responsibility, has worked for political leaders during this crisis. And I think, yeah, there are plenty of historical parallels that one could point to from earlier periods. I mean, think of Curtin in the Second World War, John Curtin as Prime Minister in the Second World War, who had no taste for leading a country at war. I mean, it wasn't his thing, but took responsibility for doing it. We've tended to reward governments or reward leaders willing to do that sort of thing.
I think, Frank, you're making a great point there about the premiers. And there's a lovely anecdote. A friend of mine was helping out in the polling booth for Labor in a coastal Queensland seat during the last state election. And you'll recall the Prime Minister spent a lot of time campaigning with the LNP leader up in Queensland, trying to help her overturn Palaszczuk. And part of this was Morrison and the state LNP Queensland leader arguing that the Queensland border should be open, despite the fact that COVID was running around in New South Wales. And Palaszczuk took a courageous and deliberate and systematically stuck to position that the Queensland border was going to stay closed until New South Wales got its COVID problem solved. Now, Morrison bullied Palaszczuk, Berejiklian bullied Palaszczuk, the New South Wales Health Minister Brad Hazard bullied Palaszczuk. I'm sitting watching this in camera thinking, wow, keep going, guys. You don't know Queenslanders very well. And of course, Palaszczuk really did win, I think, that historic third victory significantly on the back of that stand. Anyway, my mate was handing out Labor how to votes at this Queensland coastal seat, and a very old woman came up to her after she voted and said, I'd just like to tell you, I voted Labor for the first time in my life, even though my husband didn't want me to. And my mate said, oh, that's terrific. Is that because the Premier stood up to, you know, those people saying the border should be closed? And the old woman said, I voted Labor because she stood up for me.
Mm.
Now, if you can get voters from the other side coming over to your side on the basis that they feel that you are working for them and their interests, you have got it made. Now, we've got a current Labor opposition leader federally who wants to tell us again and again and again about his, you know, truly heartrending circumstances growing up. But, you know, when will Labor move on to it being about the voters in terms of the leader's narrative, not about the leader? You know, it's just so frustrating. As David Runciman has said, you know, voters look at a leader and go, do I like them? But more importantly, they then think, would that leader like me? Right? And so Morrison, in the theatre of the 2019 election, managed 5 weeks of Daggy Dad beaming potently into voters' eyes and them beaming lovingly back, and all of this theatre's being piped into the lounge rooms of Australians for 5 weeks, you know, day in, day out. Meanwhile, Shorten, Wooden, not relating visibly to voters, not liking them not liking him. I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah, and I mean, it's quite interesting if we think about Morrison too and the whole issue of responsibility. I mean, in those moments over the last year or so when he's evaded responsibility, I don't hold the hose, mate, a general sense of disengagement from the crisis in Victoria, for instance, in the middle of the year, I think that's gone down poorly with voters. I mean, we know from the movement in approval ratings, for instance, the bushfires thing did enormous damage. I mean, the Scanlon Foundation at Monash University's they did two surveys last year around public attitudes, for instance, to the handling of COVID. McGowan and the Western Australian government had a 99% approval rating for their handling of that back in July. By November, it had declined to 98%.
Now, wow, I just can't even believe those figures exist. That's amazing.
Reflected in the electoral politics when he went to the voters, because they won virtually the entire seat, all the seats, you know. So
here's a good question for a PhD student. Why is it that leaders at the state level at the moment in Australia seem to be so much better than federally? Just a footnote on Frank's figures there in relation to Morrison. It is true that he is taking a hit. And I think for the reason Frank's saying, because of this accountability shifting, kind of shape-shifting Morrison trying to squirm out of everything, is going down poorly. That said, he still remains well into net positive approval territory and has been for the entire period since the 2019 election. Anthony Albanese is resolutely and continuously in net negative approval territory. Now, the Australian election study that ANU conducts, fantastic longitudinal set of numbers. If you take a look at the last dozen elections, you'll find that it is true that the most popular leader does not always win the federal election. However, it's also true that the last three times government actually changed hands, the more popular leader won the election. So the net approval ratings and their sustained character are not the harbinger of a likely Labor victory at the next federal election.
There is so much that we've discussed today that we would love to tease out a little bit more, but we're going to have to draw this conversation to a close. We are going to come back to many of these issues over the next few weeks as we work through our leadership mini-series. And I think this conversation has just set us up so well for some of those conversations that we need to take forward. As we draw this conversation to a close, I did want to ask a final question of each of you, and that is what is the key lesson that today's leaders can take from the history of political leadership. Chris, can I ask you what it is that today's leaders might learn from history?
Well, if you want to lead, if you want to win an election, you've got to have energy. And you've got to actually be able to attract votes. So if you're a bit slow, a bit plain, you're probably not going to cut it. I'll leave it at that.
Frank?
I'll go in the exact opposite way and say if you're too focused on winning the next election and getting those votes, you'll probably be a really bad leader and you'll make bad decisions. So you need to be somewhere in between, Chris.
I think I can agree with that, Frank, and I would use Morrison as the example. Very high energy, won the election against the wooden leader, is, you know, wiping the dial over the low energy opposition leader at the minute, is delivering bad government. I think you're absolutely right, Frank. We have a unity ticket.
They are consistent, the two positions.
Yeah. Maybe we need some energetic vision and accountability from our leaders. Yeah. With that, thank you both so much for joining us today. It has been a great conversation and we really appreciate your insights. Frank Bongiorno, Chris Wallace, thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Sharon, that was a fantastic way to start our mini-series on leadership. Having Frank and Chris together in the studio was just the most wonderful way, scene-setting for the conversations that we thought were really important at this particular moment, in this particular year, at this particular time in Australian political dynamics. And I thought they did an extraordinary job of pulling apart some of the issues that we will continue to unpack over the coming weeks. What sort of things did you take away from today's conversation?
Yeah, I thought that was a terrific conversation and I could listen to Frank and Chris all day. I liked that conversation because it was a nice balance between the kind of the big ideas and the what we can learn from history, but also the really pragmatic edge of politics that, of course, shapes the behaviour of politicians because they live in that very pragmatic world. But there are a couple of things that came out that I thought were really interesting. One was around these ideas of responsibility and accountability and delivering good governance, responding to that hunger that there seems to be for a different type of governance and for a real responsiveness. And the second thing that I thought was so interesting was just how gendered Australian politics in particular are and that kind of masculine notion of politics. Do you think they're two things we should follow up on, Anna Greta?
I think they both sound really important, aren't they? The roughness of Australian politics and the gendered history. And I was really struck that having said in the opening, both of us reflecting on the call and the desire in the population for strong leadership, actually what we're looking for is good government. And so what's that relationship between leadership and good governance? That will come out, I think, over the next few weeks and how you can get good representation for what people actually want and need in their life through the sorts of leadership structures that we have.
Absolutely. So listeners, over the next few weeks, we will be delving deeper into some of these issues with some really amazing guests to continue these conversations with Frank and Chris today. So do join us for the rest of this mini-series and thank you for joining us today. Do get in touch with us and let us know your thoughts on some of these issues that we're discussing through this leadership mini-series on these issues that are just so fundamentally important to our everyday lives. And of course, get in touch with us and let us know generally how you think we're tracking. You can contact us on Twitter at APPS Policy Forum, at APPS Policy Forum, or by email through podcast@policyforum.net. You can join our Facebook group. If you just pop Policy Forum Pod into the search bar, you'll find us right there. And we would love you to leave us a review on whatever platform you listen to the pod on. We really love to read them and we do take them very seriously. So stay with us over the next few weeks as we keep talking about leadership and next week as we think about this really important issue of local leadership. But for now, from me, Sharon Bessel, it's bye-bye for now.
Bye, Sharon. I'll see you next week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.